who are you when you're alone in a room and no one's watching you? Would you still do the things that you're doing? And if the answer is no, then it should be an assessment of, are my actions aligning with who I am? Is this a decision out of ego, or is it really trying to get closer to meaning?
This is Audience of One, and I'm your host, Spencer Keir. This podcast is a venue for me to follow my curiosity through conversations with leading thinkers and builders. My guest today is Nicole. She's the writer of the Starting From Nick Substack. We talk about writing, introspection, being heart versus head heavy, what's core to your identity, pursuing meaning over ego, living in the present, depth and endurance, and more. Please enjoy. How did your journey with writing begin? And has it been continuous ever since you first started dabbling with writing? Or were there kind of, was it stop and go? And then more recently, you kind of picked up momentum.
When I think back to my childhood and just growing up, I realized that I've been writing for a really long time, like maybe not consistently over 10 years. But I think if you look back, and I know that we both listen to a lot of podcasts with who talk about founders, who talk about people who have been, who really develop and hone their skill. I think if you look back across their life, they've always been dabbling in it, or it comes from a very deep root. And then they develop it slowly, curate their taste over time, and then get better at that craft itself. And I've always been writing since I was like a child. I used to write poetry and then kind of started getting into more of this essay themes that I started seeing maybe around 2 years ago. But before that, I was writing on like all the platforms like WordPress, Blogspot, Wix, Wattpad, like all of those things. And it looked very different than it does now. But I would say that I've just always been writing. And I think one of the reasons why writing feels like a really important art form to me is that it's really about articulating the way that you see the world and how you notice things in the world, the patterns you pick up. And I find that writing is actually a process of clarifying your own thoughts. And how are you going to put that into the world and how people are going to receive it? So it also acts as a mirror for other people, how they're experiencing things, giving words to emotions that we all experience. And so I guess that's what kind of brought me to writing, always been doing it. And then felt the power of the personal essay more recently in the past 2 years through reading different people's. I think I started seeing the first like fledgling spots of people coming up in Substack. And then started that. So that's where I've been the past 2 years.
There's always a common question when it comes to writing. And I think the same applies across a number of mediums, but I think particularly around writing, about finding your voice and how long it took you to find your voice, what the process was. I saw in one of your recent posts, you said that you don't feel like you're yet creating the kind of work that you want to be, but you know it's on the horizon and it's forever on the horizon because you're always improving. But I'm curious how long it took you to get to a point where you found at least the rough kind of shape or environment through which you could create the kind of work you want to be doing, have that voice. And why do you still feel like you're not there quite yet? What's missing?
Yeah, a few things. I think that I'm sure you've heard of this concept called the taste gap. And if not, it was by Ira Glass. And he was saying that the quality of your taste is higher than what you're producing. And that's good in one hand because you have something to strive for and you have this model of what you want your work to look like, but it's not quite there yet. So that gap can be quite frustrating. And that taste gap is why people quit, because they feel like what they want to create is just not what they're creating. And I think that any creative person will tell you that they have these idols or people that they look up to whose writing is, for example, fluid, melodic, slots into place, is concise, articulate, things like that. And you want to be that so badly. And when you don't measure up, it's like almost like a heartbreak. So I think my whole like theory about writing, or how I think of it, is that in order to bridge that gap, what you have to do is to be really prolific and really intentional about how you're going to improve that, improve the work that you're putting out into the world, and being consistent with something like a craft. And I think that, and I'm sure you've felt this through podcasting, but you can't just like start and stop. You kind of have to keep going and keep persevering, even when people aren't reading your work. That's the only way that you can get to a quality in which your work becomes visible to others through organic means. Like the only way that your writing can become so good that people want to read it, like organically. And so I think that's kind of the way I've been approaching writing, like just keep going, keep like chipping away at it. I think that's how I describe it in some of my posts. I'm just like, I'm just here chipping one single block at a time. And every week I'm posting something. It may not be something I'm the most proud of or something that I feel is life-changing, groundbreaking, but it's always getting me closer, at least to what I think I want to be writing and experimenting. And then that's just inching me closer to what I want it to look like.
I interpreted the idea of taste gap as almost like your writing or whatever content you're creating is almost a lagging indicator of what you're consuming or how refined your taste is, which is fascinating. I guess at the beginning of your writing, were you more goal or milestone oriented rather than about the process? Or have you always been about the process? Because I think that is the most critical thing I've identified in anybody who's prolific in their work is falling in love with the process, right? It's cliche to say it, but you kind of make this full circle journey where you're like, oh, that's a cliche. Not really going to listen to that. You go and do the work and you find out, oh, there's a lot of truth in that, as there are many cliches. But did you have to develop that sense of enjoying the process or was it always present for you?
I think you're so right in saying that a lot of like these like cliched like metaphors that we live by, a lot of them are just like a series of us actually realizing them through experience and then being like, oh, they were right all along. And I feel like so much of wisdom that I feel like I've gained over the years through multiple sources have always just been like, oh, they were right. I just had to experience right. it to really fully recognize it. I think the process of writing for me is super therapeutic. So I've always really liked it. It's always been something that I think there's a few things that you can't escape from, like a few parts of your personality that will just come out no matter what. And I think mm-hmm. that writing or recording or trying to express myself through words or through art, that has always been a part of my personality. And if it weren't through writing, it would have come out some other way. I don't know. That's kind of my random theory that I feel like if there's a like almost like a bedrock part of your personality, it's going to come out in different ways until it expresses itself correctly. So for me, writing felt like a very natural process of transcribing my thoughts and wanting people to see the reality that I was seeing, I guess, or trying to make that more accessible to people, that all of our problems, all the things that we think about are all actually very similar at the core. And there's something that, you know, threads through this human experience that we all go through. And I feel like writing for me was the process of excavating that out of myself and then trying to link it with other people.
In my episode with Isabel, who I think you're familiar with, her handle is Isabel Unraveled. She had this line that was something to the effect of the individual is also universal, like that individual principle yeah. or you know, kind of truth you come across ends up also being widely applicable. So there's a lot of overlap there. Have you found that through the process of your writing, you have more so been doing that excavation, like you said, or have you felt like you always had a sense of who you were and it was more so finding the appropriate words to kind of illuminate that or bring it out into the public to communicate it?
I think definitely the former. I think myself continues to evolve and so much of what I feel like I believed or thought, I've changed my mind across the years. I think that's just a process of growing up and seeing the world and also running into perspectives that clash with yours and then doing some really deep introspection into why does this way of living either not match up with mine or why do I feel dissonant towards it and what does that mean? And I think that so often we get trapped in these echo bubbles of like, what are you meant to be doing? What are you meant to be writing? What are you meant to be thinking about? And then the more time you spend at the edge cases of that or like different types of perspectives, then you realize like there's no one right way to do one thing. And it's more like figuring out what's that right thing for you. But that requires a lot of introspection and self-awareness and getting to the root of who you are, really, through like reading, through thinking, all that. So I feel like it's a constantly evolving process, which I hope to track through writing. And like one of the reasons I started my Substack was actually a couple of people, I have all these conversations with my friends, and it's basically all of these topics and stuff are things I talk with my friends about. And one day I was like, why not just transcribe these conversations I'm having with friends into these themes and topics that I feel are going to be resonant with other people? So I think so much of that is just like us changing together, us growing, and then me trying to write that down into a blog post, basically.
You've mentioned a couple of times now this concept of there being things that are, and this appears a few times in your writing as well, this concept of there being things that are core to you versus either could be malleable depending on like your interactions with particular people or the environment in which you are occupying. What have you found to be kind of central or consistent to you? And maybe conversely, what are the things most recently that you found to be a little bit more flexible or malleable?
I think that there is like definitely a core kind of personality to everyone. And one of mine, I think, that I was trying to hide for a long time, or I think I felt a bit ashamed of, was that I think that I'm quite a sensitive person, which means that I take inputs from the world and the way that I digest them is perhaps more sensitive than I would like. And I think I've always tried to kind of counterbalance that by trying to be like this boss girl or trying to lead a career in which I felt counteracted those sensitive tendencies in myself. And I think over time, it's been an accepting of like your, whatever you see as like your kind of weak points are actually your strengths. And this sensitivity also lends itself to sensitivity, to beauty, to empathy, to being able to see the world in a very nuanced way, to being able to notice things that are beautiful or are touching or letting me experience this like larger spectrum of emotion that I think I've been trying to really be able to condense that and to work that through myself and making that core something that I'm really proud of and not something that I have to hide or mask with all these other things that are very malleable, right? For example, job, your occupation, things like that. Even your friendships or your relationships, all of that is very changeable according to who you are and who you are in a particular moment. So I think that's my core. That's like this, like, my soul that's really wants to like understand the world, take in all of this information, make something beautiful out of it. I think that's the core of who I am. And then, you know, there's things on top of that that make you a complex being. Like everyone has all these multifaceted personalities. So it can be like the part, like my occupation that I also really enjoy that's very different to my online personality, and keeping that very separate. And then, you know, for example, like other interests that I've picked up over the years, I think those are changeable, and also environment, right? So what city you choose to be in, things like that, I think all have a large impact on your personality, but the core of you remains the same.
Would you liken this concept of sensitivity to vulnerability with I think vulnerability is both like a negative and positive connotation, but in the positive sense, or like openness? And if so, why do you think you tried to suppress that? Was it the fear of being hurt or embarrassed, or the sense of like you could be overanalyzing things that coming across to people? Why did you kind of shy away or try to suppress that?
Yeah, I think a lot of it goes back to growing up in Asia and feeling like that was a burden more than a kind of a strength. And even like being in the humanities, for example, when I was growing up, was not a very popular thing. Like no one really cared too much about writing or things that I was caring about. I felt like wasn't really valued. And so I think that part of myself was always like, okay, that's fun. That's like Nicole, like just having fun. And then what's Nicole going to do when she like wants to be taken seriously? And I think so many people have that, right? And I'm sure like, maybe not you in particular, but I'm sure people have hobbies or even parts of their personality that they try to hide because they're not, they don't feel like it's socially super rewarded to like Absolutely. Those things. And so I think that there's a freedom to putting your thoughts out into the world and being like, okay, like that's maybe not the most socially rewarded, but it is me and I'm going to be true to myself. And there's something very freeing about that, I think.
Is there a connection between that and why you've chosen to keep kind of these, I'll call it like your physical, your work identity, and then your online and kind of writing or creative identity separate? Or was that an intentional decision for another reason? And if so, what was that other reason?
I think going a bit more like not anonymous because it's still kind of my avatar. Yeah. But going a little bit more low profile in terms of like what I physically look like or what I do day to day, things like that, was a pretty intentional decision of mine. And I think the way I see it is that I wanted to just be really free to create what I wanted without it being super tied to, yeah, exactly, my prestige or the things that I'd done in my life outside of writing. I wanted it to be like a standalone thing in a sort of way. I don't know if everyone feels that or like people really want to be tied to their identity, but for me, at least, it felt very freeing. And it felt just like an avenue where I could just experiment or play. And I think that's a big thing about being semi-anonymous, pseudonymous, is that I just feel like I'm free to play and like experiment, have a bit of fun and not worry too much that, for example, like employers are going to find me or people are going to judge me for what I look like or my like school or whatever. So I think that was my reason for doing so.
Have you found that either what preempted that or as a result of creating these kind of two separate personas, that you do view yourself as almost multiple personas? Or is there kind of under the surface like this integrated or unified sense of self? It just kind of depending on the moment or the kind of channel that you want to output your energy manifests in different ways. Do you have this sense of like, I'm this person here in this context and this person in this other one, or is it more integrated underneath the surface?
The question of context is something I think about a lot because I read this book a while ago and it's, I'm blanking on the name at the moment, but there was this concept of high monitoring people versus low self-monitoring people. And high self-monitoring people are those people that, for example, go to a party and chameleon themselves into whoever the party's occupants want them to be. Low self-monitoring people are people who are just themselves, like very solidly across different environments. And that can come with both pros and cons because sometimes you need to read the room, for example, and low self-monitoring people will not read the room. And so it's about finding where do you sit on that spectrum of high versus low self-monitoring. And I've thought about this a lot. And I think that I think I'm probably towards the higher end of self-monitoring. I think that I have different selves that express themselves in different scenarios, which may not be the best. Like maybe I should be more low self-monitoring. And maybe my writing is a way to inch towards being more myself in every single context, in every single place, with every single person. So I think being aware of that, of being where you fall on that scale actually is pretty good for like self-awareness. Like even if you do that exercise yourself, like where do you fall on that scale, you know? And thinking about that is important because then you know how much you're like malleable to social interactions, things like that.
I think that's a worthwhile exercise for everyone. And for what it's worth, I don't think there is a should. And for context on any episode I do with anybody, all of my questions come from a very personal place. And so it might feel at times like the guest is kind of being like, not necessarily attacked, but like poked at, is because I see reflective attributes in them that I'm trying to understand myself. And so understanding what I feel like are similar or like-minded individuals, I can kind of tease that out within myself. I feel like I have different personalities in different contexts as well. And so I always wonder if people view themselves in this like integrated, always consistent, coherent, way of being. But I don't think, in fact, that is the way most people are. And also there is no should. So it's okay if you're one or the other. You mentioned this idea of potentially through your writing, you are inching closer to being more of that. There's a phrase you used in one of your pieces that was like heart heavy. And maybe that's tied in also with this idea of being vulnerable or sensitive to the environment. And you also said in that same piece that you felt like some of your best experiences or work came from that place of being more heart heavy. Do you feel yourself being pulled in that direction more towards, you can also think about it as like the right versus left brain. Do you feel yourself being pulled more in that direction, or does it just depend on the time and day?
I think that to kind of ground everyone in like what heart heavy and head heavy, kind of what that theory was that I was having a ton of conversations with people about this concept that I had come up with, that I felt maybe not cleanly bifurcated people, but I noticed a trend in different types of people. Either you're head heavy or you're heart heavy. And head heavy looks like someone who's very rational, someone who has kind of a set trajectory for how they want things to work out. They have steps, they have discipline and where they're going to go. They have a lot of direction. And so this can be great if you're someone who can plan things out, can really hold yourself to a standard and wants to reach it. But it can also be hard because then you start to ignore things like intuition, or you start to ignore like other signals that maybe you should think about and maybe wasn't in your plan, but could actually lead you to some really fascinating doors that could be opened to different paths in your life that you may not have gone down naturally or instinctually. And then heart-heavy people are people who really go at life with this sense of, I'm going to follow whatever this voice is in my head that's telling me where to go. And I have so much magnitude and I'm going to just like go at it with all that I've got. And you see this in kind of like, for example, founders tend to be quite heart-heavy. Because they see this reality that just doesn't exist and they are striving to make it happen. And sometimes heart heaviness can also lead you to things like ignoring status games because you're so sure of this idea that you want to go after it. But it can also lead you astray because maybe you don't have a plan, maybe you don't have direction, things like that. And neither is better or worse. Like, it's not like a moral valence thing to be head heavy or heart heavy. But what I've noticed is that people tend to have like one or two camps that they fall into, at least predominantly. Of course, everyone's complex. And I think in a lot of my writing, I've alluded to or talked about how I think I moved through my life mostly head heavy, super stubbornly, actually, when I think about it. And I have this plan or the structure, the scaffolding that I think, or taxonomy or whatever we want to call it, that like I feel like my life has been taking place. And that has been really great for me in terms of like, for example, professional success or things that felt like I should be getting there. But then it felt kind of hollow at the same time where I was like, oh, I'm on the right path, but it doesn't feel quite right. Like I feel quite like I'm missing something or I'm not devoting myself to something that feels meaningful. And so it's been kind of a journey for me to figure out, you know, how can I lean more into the heart heaviness or not always have to rationalize everything? And I think as well, like being in the Bay and, you know, being part of like tech circles, like a lot of it is also like rationalizing different things or having logic to map out different pathways and like all of these things of optimization. And I think that there's also another angle, which is like much softer and maybe more intangible and perhaps seems less legitimate, but is as fairly legitimate as all of these like proofs and logic to get you where you want to go and to get you to those doors that are going to be unfamiliar, but potentially life-changing. So I think a lot of my conversations were around that. And I think where I landed was like, yeah, I'm trying to be more heart heavy instead of like mapping everything out. Like you can't map everything out. Like eventually it's going to crack, you know? And I'd be curious, like you, if, like, how would you identify yourself? Like, would you say you're in the more heart heavy or head heavy camp?
I think I'm feeling at a, and there's a reason I have like 7 questions on this document related to this concept, is because I've been feeling the sense of change as well, where I've definitely been historically tried to guide myself through logic, but have always felt this like emotional, kind of almost more romantic, intuitive pull. And I don't always listen to it. And there's this one essay I've been trying to write for like 6 months that really gets to the heart of this issue. And I don't have a good answer yet, except to say, I think I want to lead more with my intuition. I think as you get more reps and experience in life, to the point of taste, like you develop more of a compass that you can lean into. But it's scary to kind of let go of the wheel and let your gut kind of guide things entirely. So trying to find the way to go back to this concept of like the integrated self, where you can almost put guardrails or checks and balances in place using that logical part of yourself. Cool. Like for example, with your writing, you use the more logical part of yourself to say, I'm going to create a practice where I'm going to write every day. If you were just purely led by the heart, it might be like, oh, I don't want to write for 5 weeks. And then you go on a bender and write for 48 hours straight. Not to say one is better than the other, I'm not sure. But I feel like I do still need a little bit of that logical aspect to me. So it's finding where, picking the places in my life where I incorporate that in the right way.
Yeah, I feel like everyone's been going through this kind of meaning crisis, I think maybe post-COVID, where people are really wondering, like, all of my plans kind of didn't pan out the way that I thought they were going to pan out. Or I was planning to, for example, I heard a lot of people saying, like, I was planning to do this after I graduated, and I had stacked up all my credits or whatever to make sure I could take a semester off and go and do something that I wanted to do. But because of doing that, I had like a really hard college life or whatever. And then in the end, COVID happened and they couldn't do the thing that they wanted to do. So I feel like a lot of people have been renegotiating their relationship with planning or trying to predict everything.
That's a great insight. I think, I can't tell, always within like our corner of Twitter, I think it is, it's not entirely reflective of like the general population, but I've been seeing that trend absolutely. And I think it's also connected to, you know, the great resignation, the pathless path, if you've heard of like Paul Millard's book.
Yeah, Paul.
This is all pretty connected. And part of me absolutely feels that and empathizes with it, and wonders if I need to explore that kind of less planned approach to life. But then part of me also is like, is this a societal or cultural overcorrection to COVID? And is the pendulum, I mean, as it is, it's always swinging, but is it going to swing back to a more kind of in between, an equilibrium, where maybe instead it's like, no, I have a more reasonable 9-to-5, but I pursue my hobby on the side. I'm not sure. But I'm the rationalizing part of me is trying to look at this like trend as a whole and see if I'm going to get sucked up into it, or if it is there's absolutely truth in it, but is it, you know, applicable to my individual situation, I suppose.
Yeah, definitely.
There was this point in one of your pieces, I imagine it was a throwaway line of sorts, but absolutely something you've been thinking about, where you said something to the effect of, you're not free in all of the ways you want to be free. Maybe this is connected to this idea of you know, the heart heaviness. But what are the ways in life where you aspire towards or desire freedom, but for whatever reason haven't been able to obtain that? And are you actively trying to reverse that or pursue that freedom?
I have a lot of thoughts on this topic because I came across this post by Ribbon Farm And this is where this concept came from. It was actually around creating your circle and making good friends and finding the right people to surround yourself with in a way that encourages you to think beyond yourself and encourages you to think beyond the way that you were operating in the past. And the quote was something along the lines of, don't seek people who are quote unquote smarter or better than you. Instead, you should seek people out who are free in ways that you're not. And then it goes into an understanding of like, what does differently free mean? And what does it mean for someone to have a freedom that you don't have? And for sure, there's like different types of freedoms we all have that are like, for example, privilege, things like that. But I think I want to focus on like maybe like mental freedom or things that people have that I've noticed and why I choose to surround myself with a lot of people that I feel have a different way and perspective of living than I do. And I find that incredibly refreshing. And I think that used to be jarring to me. I used to surround myself with people that were very similar to me, all thought in a similar way, all thought success was this linear, particular paved path, and we were all gearing towards the same thing. And that gave me a sense of camaraderie and relatability, I guess. But I realized at some point that your friendships are what are going to, well, first of all, your friendships are actually like some of the longest lasting relationships in your life. So the people that you choose to surround yourself with are going to define your mindset and define what you understand as what you can do. And once I started meeting a lot of different types of people, either through the internet or through work or through different activities that were differently free than me, I realized how much I had been trapped in a mindset that I thought only a certain thing was possible. And after I saw someone else do something that I thought was impossible, that expanded my vision for what could even be possible. Like, for example, that doesn't even have to be close friends, but let's say people writing online. Before I had seen anyone write on Substack or let's say grow an audience or make money on Substack, not that I monetize my blog, but just being able to see someone create a life for themselves that I just honestly didn't think was possible, I think was just so inspiring to me. And it unlocked a freedom within myself where I was like, okay, like people can do it. I can do it, you know? And I think that's the most empowering thing. That's literally what the word, like, I think empowerment means, is that really unlocking that possibility for someone else. And so whenever I meet someone new, I'm never like, oh, where did they come from? What are they doing? All this stuff. It's always like, how are they free in a way that I can recognize and I can honor and I can learn from? And when you see people like that, rather than like numbers or schools or accolades, and you start seeing them as like just holistic people and with different skills, different talents and different pathways, I think that's when you open up a whole nother level of how you can connect with other people and also learn from them. So I think that's kind of like the context of that freedom. And that's something I'm like gearing towards, just like expanding my view of what can I do with writing, right? How can I make this like a bigger part of my life? Because I'm so interested in it. I find it fun. You know, how do I make it something that I really enjoy and can consistently keep up for the rest of my life? Maybe to build a community or just keep this like longevity journaling kind of thing going on. And then it's appeared in my life in smaller ways too. It's like, can I speak to someone at a party that I'm like, like I don't have the social, I don't feel like socially graceful. Like, what if I want to like say hi to people? How do I meet new people? It's all very basic stuff. You know what I mean? But yeah. It's like, yeah, when I think about freedom, I'm like, okay, these are like different things I can learn from different people.
It works at different levels of abstraction, like you're talking about as well. It's a very useful mental model. One of the other areas of freedom that has always been a challenge for me that I identified in your work, you had said something to the effect of you spend 50% of your life living in the past. For me, I actually think it's living in the future, like fantasizing about or fearing certain things that are to come or most likely aren't to come. How have you become more free in that way? And what kind of tools or mechanisms have you found to be useful for freeing yourself from the past?
I think that I consider myself quite a nostalgic person. And so that's why I think I said, you know, I live 50% in the past. And I had this conversation with my roommate. We were standing in the kitchen and she was telling me she thinks she lives 90% of her life in the present. And I was just so shocked by that. And I was like, wow, that's really incredible. Like, I think that's great that first of all, you recognize that. And it's like an active awareness thing that she's in the present. And I think that just shocked me because, yeah, so much of our time is split between the past and the future. It's like, oh, what did I do in the past? I regret that. And then what am I going to do in the future when I get this thing? And that can lead down a very slippery slope because it's just like all these fantasies or imaginations of what it could be, rather than being like very grounded in what's happening now. How do I feel at this moment? What are the things that I am looking forward to like right now, and how am I feeling about it right now? And I think that's a very powerful way to live your life. Just being fully, fully here and not somewhere else. And it's also like, for example, imagine you're talking to yourself and that other person, I mean, sometimes you can tell when you're having a conversation, that person's head is not at the present. It's not fully focused on you. I think that's kind of the same thing when we're like thinking about ourselves. It's like, are you like fully here? And if not, that's kind of distracting. Like, where are you? You know? So I think that certain practices, I think, can get you more grounded in the present. Like, I think journaling is a huge one for me and is a huge like creativity starter, at least. I find journaling to really anchor me into the thoughts that are running through my mind all the time that I never pause to give any reflection or weight to. Like sometimes I find myself when I'm writing, like sometimes I do morning pages, which is like this 3 to 4 page free flow writing. Sometimes things will come out that I wasn't even actively thinking about. When I wrote them down, I'm like, oh, this was on my mind. I just had chosen to shove it in the back corner of my head and left it there. So I think journaling is a huge one. I've heard good things about meditation. I'm going to be honest, I don't meditate as much as I should. So I feel like that's like a super grounding practice that people have told me is just so somatic and leads to greater awareness. So I think that's something I would love to incorporate. And I think just having the mindset that, you know, nothing in the past can come back and nothing in the future has happened yet. So it's kind of grounding yourself in that the only thing that you can control is the present moment. Even your future is dependent on what you do right now, right? So it's kind of like by anchoring into that present moment, you're actually unlocking more possibilities for the future. So I think that's the way that I try to think about it. So hopefully inching towards that.
Have you found that the dwelling on the past or the sense of nostalgia is also related to this like overly analytical aspect that you have? I have that at least, so I might be projecting a bit. But I'm constantly analyzing life, like I said, mostly in the future, but a bit in the past as well. Do you find that those two things are connected? And if so, how have you found the ability to analyze life a little bit less, understanding that there is still a certain amount that needs to be done? You can't just always be flying by the seat of your pants. Have you found that optimal split between like analyzing life versus actually living it and kind of putting blinders on or earplugs in regards to this like overly analytical voice that's in your head?
Yeah, I think it's definitely tied to having an analytical interior monologue. And I saw this stat, I don't know if it's true or not, but I heard it was like maybe 30%, 50%. I don't know the statistic, but like 30% of people don't have an internal monologue.
I just saw
and
that as well, yeah.
I think it was like someone was making a joke. It was like, this explains so much. And yeah, I think that, you know, if you have a very analytical mind, it's very easy to keep digging things up and reanalyzing them and questioning, how could I have acted differently? How come I couldn't be the person that I am today back then and acted in that way? I think I found a lot of peace with that, you know, it's good to actually look back and be cringing at yourself, because that means that you've actually done enough growth to a point where you can recognize that. And I think I've made peace with that and been like, okay, there's a few things in my past that feel like I could have done better. but it's like continuous learning, right? That's what gets you to where you are today. And so I think that's just like my stance on constantly analyzing instead being like, okay, like it's good that I'm feeling bad about this. It's actually a positive signal. It means I'm putting enough weight in like personal growth that I feel like I've changed since then.
Right.
And I think tangentially, it's really good to understand why you change and why you change your mind. And how do you get from something that you had thought was fact and realize that that was your own fiction? And that was something that I wrote about recently as well. It's that like, we all exist in our own fictions, and it's up to us to recognize what is a fiction that we've created for ourselves, and we're living it as if we're like the main narrator of this fiction. And how do we understand that it is a fiction and that everything is kind of determined by the way we look at it? And owning your responsibilities and owning the things that you've done, I think is partially the way to escape that fiction. But still fleshing out my thoughts on that.
Do you ever escape the fiction, or is it just telling yourself a slightly better fiction that is maybe slightly more in alignment with reality?
I think we're always telling ourselves stories, but I think that the story maybe gets truer over time, or there's more maybe fidelity to who you really truly are. It gets clearer over time or sharper. So I think maybe small incremental closeness is what I'm trying to get at.
I think I'd agree with that. The next three all have to do with kind of disparate excerpts that I pulled from a number of your pieces that really resonated with me. The first one is, I was rewarded back when I was a kid for curiosity. Nowadays, I'm rewarded mostly for efficiency and clarity. And having worked in education for 10 years, like have absolutely felt this both in helping or working with kids, but then also inside myself. How do you get closer to the kind of work in adult life that does reward you for curiosity? I think writing is one of those, but obviously you're still holding down a 9-to-5. How do you find that kind of work that is curiosity led or rewarding, but also ideally can help kind of pay the bills or help you with those financial responsibilities?
For a long time, I feel like work, as defined by myself, I guess, was something that someone else told you to do. And it was like an employer is telling you to do this. But I think my thinking has evolved over time to this point where I think work can be something that you also have agency over, and something that you're working towards. It doesn't necessarily have to be, for example, your profession. So I think I would say that first, that I think I've kind of changed my mind that work had to be something that was given to me, and instead something I want to chart for myself. And then second of all, I think being rewarded for curiosity, I think at work, or at least in a professional setting, I think it's being in a place that allows you to experiment without fear of failure and feeling psychologically safe. And I can extrapolate that to everything too. It's not just work. Like even doing any creative project with another person, let's say, or by yourself, you have to feel like you're in a psychologically safe place to be able to share those things. And so I think curating those spaces for yourself, or seeking out people that embody that for you, is the way to approach that. I think in terms of professional life, I think to be completely candid, I'm still figuring that out. And I don't really have any shame in like saying that. I think that everything is just like a continuous journey. And you're always trying to figure out what the next thing is that's going to enable you to be more curious at work or be more curious in your life. And that starts with your individual agency, right? How can I be curious in my life? And maybe perhaps that's going to extend to my professional life in the future, but how can I be curious about my experience in the world, the people around me, ideas and concepts beyond what I'm used to? So let's say, for example, like reading one type of book and reading a variety of different types of books to understand like different ways of thinking, different ways of being. I think that's kind of the mode I find myself most geared to, at least right now, is that how do I embrace curiosity in my own life? And then in the future, will extend to other parts of my life, because that's the way agency works. Like, you work towards one thing, you just put your effort towards one thing. And I really believe that if you do that sincerely, it will expand the rest of your life. It just takes time.
The next one is the modern passage to self-reinvention relies on disposability, on churn. Can you, I have an interpretation of this, but I'd love if you could elaborate on that.
Yeah, I feel like nowadays, at least, there's so much emphasis on things that you can change quickly about yourself. And so much of what I write about and what I've been realizing is that anything good or anything meaningful comes from longevity of effort and intentional effort and just being able to stick it out, honestly. I know so many people who have told me they start things and they end it very quickly because it's not giving them the results that they want. But anything really good actually takes so much time to pick up speed, pick up momentum. And if you're like a very momentum-driven person, it can feel like a long slog. But at the end of that is something that will last you the rest of your life. And I think about this a lot with writing. Like, when I started writing, it was literally to no one. Like, before Substack even began, I mean, I was writing on this obscure website. I don't even know. It wasn't even WordPress. It was extremely obscure. Like, no one was reading my writing. But to me, I was like, what's going to really matter is like longevity of this. Like, I don't care if I reach this in like a year or 3 years. It's more like, can I just keep going? And can I just keep incrementally getting better and feeling better about where I'm at? And if so, then that's the way to go, right? And I think this relates to that quote that you mentioned, because I think so much about it is like buying the next product or buying the course or, you know, doing these little optimizations, which I still do, by the way. I'm still like, you know, very, very involved with the material world. But I think that there should be a focus on like, how can I endure? What is something I can do for the rest of my life? You know, how can I like really put endurance as the focus rather than success in the first month?
Yeah, I think it's also symptomatic of the rate of, I mean, both of us work in technology. The rate of change, especially if you look over the last, call it like 3 or 4 years, the number of waves that have happened, and you've seen founders jump ship from idea to idea. If you get caught up in whatever is viral or trendy at the moment, it's going to be very difficult, if not impossible, to find that longevity. And this also goes back to one of the initial topics we talked about around being process driven or doing the thing for the sake of the thing. I think there's a tight connection between that kind of external validation or motivation and this rate of change. If you were looking for whatever's happening in society or culture or technology as your kind of compass for what you're doing, then you're just going to be thrown into a blender and constantly changing direction. So it's something I've been trying to cultivate within myself as well. And I think it takes that deep introspective work, like you had alluded to earlier, to do it, which a lot of people, frankly, either don't want to do or are kind of willfully blind to. The last quote I wanted to touch on that is incredibly deep is, and I should have provided the additional context around this, but hopefully you remember it. The quote was, is it ego or is it meaning? Can you, there's a lot there, but what kind of, if you remember, what was the impetus for writing that? And then how should people think about that?
I think this is super tied to what we were discussing about, like, I guess, rationalism or going the logical way or what you think is going to be very well rewarded in society or in your circles in particular. And thinking about, is this something that feeds my ego? And really digging deep into, why are you doing certain things that you're doing? What really motivates you? Who are you when you're alone in a room and no one's watching you? Would you still do the things that you're doing? And if the answer is no, then it should be an assessment of, are my actions aligning with who I am? And I think that's a thought process or a kind of conundrum that people face at a certain point in their life. And at different points in everyone's life, I think they think about this, like, what am I doing this all for? And is it for me? Is it for my community? Is it for, like, prestige? And I think so much of what I've been trying to do the past few years is rewire how I think about that and really try to align myself at the best that I can to fulfilling things that have meaning to me personally. And that's, for example, through writing this blog for 2 years plus, and pretty much writing every week, which feels like a sacrifice in some ways, because it's like that time could be put to doing something else that could potentially feed my ego. Mm. But I know that writing provides me so much meaning, and I feel the most free and the most myself when I'm doing it, and creating art and being able to connect with so many people over our shared lived experiences. And I think that's something that you have to reflect on, like, whatever you're doing, is it providing that connection? Is it providing that sense of epiphany where it's like, oh, I love this. Like, I'm really interested in this, and I would do it even if no one watches me. I think that's a question that I think about a lot. And yeah, maybe don't have the answers to, but I think that's a question I ask myself a lot whenever I'm taking a next step or walking through a door, let's say making a decision. Is this a decision out of ego, or is it really trying to get closer to meaning?
This topic has come up a lot on this podcast, and I've been thinking about this a lot myself. The framing of who are you when you're by yourself in your room alone, I think, is a good additional angle or different framing for thinking about it. I found in my own experience that it feels like I ask this question, or I seek meaning maybe more than I try to live as a means of finding that meaning, if that makes sense. Like, living in my head, trying to play out or ask myself a series of questions, ask why enough to where I get to it, rather than just like interacting with reality and getting feedback from it. How do you know when to live versus, you know, versus going into this deep cycle of analyzing who I am, where do I find meaning, et cetera?
It can definitely get into, for example, you can definitely overanalyze yourself too. Yeah. And I think that that's like a trap that I think people of a certain type fall into, and I'm definitely not in that type. But I think that something that has helped me is just following interests, because I think interests are the most organic thing that's going to lead you to meaning. And I think there was a very recent Paul Graham essay about how your interest is your biggest differentiator. And I thought that essay was great because it was so simple and so resonant with me, that whatever you're interested in, it's you're interested in it for a reason. And sometimes your interest can lead you down to understand things in a deeper way, to uncover gaps and how to fill those gaps. And I think that how to find meaning is actually just following your interests and then seeing where that leads. So there's a bit of that organic interest where you think something's cool, but you're not sure what exactly it is you're following. But as you get to those questions or those things that you're understanding through your interest, more questions will rise, more deep feelings and thoughts will emerge. And then you can follow that rabbit hole as far as it leads you. And I also think there's no shame in like going down your interest and realizing, hey, like, this is a chapter in my life. It's not going to be my whole life. Why don't I close this chapter and go down a different interest? And I think that that's a way of living your life where it is organic. It is living life, right? But it also is in pursuit of perhaps a greater meaning, or even in pursuit of a chapter that leads you to your next project or greater meaning. So I think that would be my very simplistic answer to that question.
Yeah, no, not so simple. There's like this triumvirate of awareness, agency, and curiosity, I think, that's kind of like continuously reared its head to me. The awareness piece is both in the present moment, like in the micro understanding what's going on, but then also like the awareness of self, like understanding who you actually are, what you want. The agency is like the kind of motor for going and getting it, and the curiosity is like the where, or the kind of direction you're going. And I think those three paired with just like the internet, the access to information, access to people and networks is like truly anything's possible nowadays, as opposed to, you know, hundreds of years ago. But the intersection of like that, those three concepts with like the access we have nowadays, I think if you can really unlock those things or internalize them, embody them, it sounds cliche, but like the world truly is your oyster.
I love that. And I think I was at this dinner party like months ago at this point, and there's something that someone said that still stuck with me, that was, you know, you kind of need both, and it's tied to what you're saying about agency and direction. He was saying, yeah, you need both magnitude and direction. Like you need enough energy or enough activation energy for this magnitude, this like aura, this action to be happening. But you also need this like sense of direction of like where to go and what questions to answer and what people to find. And when you find those two, like the magnitude and direction, that makes you really unstoppable. And it was just like some offhand comment, but I don't know. I've been thinking about that for a while. And I think most things that really impact me are just something that someone said on an off chance. And then I heard it and it somehow resonated very deeply. So I think that was very relevant to what you were just saying.
Yeah, that resonates with me as well. Have you found that those things that resonate most deeply with you have already been kind of percolating, or you've been thinking about, and somebody just provides words for it in a way you hadn't thought about? Or is there this actual like come out of nowhere epiphany realization that just like smacks you in the face? Because I go back and forth, and I think there are situations for each, but I found in my own life more recently, it's a lot of coming up with these ideas, these concepts. And then speaking of Paul Graham, like I just read his How to Do Great Work essay the other week. And he just put words to so much of what I've been thinking about. And yet there's these other moments like you're talking about potentially where things just kind of smack you over the head and you're like, oh, why have I never thought about it that way? Does one or of those two, I guess, occur more frequently in your life?
The first, I think, most of the conversations I feel really strike me are so compelling because it was something that had been stewing maybe under the surface, or I hadn't put language to it. And that's also why I find language and writing so powerful. It's because it is all of these things that we've been incubating kind of under some heat and some thoughts, but hadn't really like fully emerged as a fully fledged idea of theory. And when people feel that and they feel like you can articulate what has been going on in their lives, then it feels like a light bulb moment. And I think the more times I've experienced that in writing, the more times I realize that it is possible for words to carry such power and to also unlock something in you that you maybe had been kind of, had been under the surface and needed someone to help you understand. And that's what reading and writing has done for me. So definitely the former.
Yeah. To bring it full circle to writing. Well, the final question I always ask everyone is to turn it back on you. What's one question you'd leave for me or listeners to think about or act on?
Maybe a more kind of reflection question or a journaling question, perhaps. But it would be, how most recently have you changed your mind and why?
Great question. Well, Nicole, thank you so much for your time. We even went well over, and I know it's a Friday, so I'll let you go, but really enjoyed this conversation. Really enjoyed reading all of your essays as well.
Thank you, Spencer. Really enjoyed this conversation as well.